Chapter 46. Dor naturally heard the noise, and greeted it with a triumphant screech. Ha! I've managed to wake you up, the very savagery of which had a laughable effect. I felt the weight of Donorita grow on my arm, and thought it best to let her sink on the floor, wishing to be free in my movements and really afraid that now he had actually heard a noise he would infallibly burst the door. But he didn't even thump it. He seemed to have exhausted himself in that scream. There was no other light in the room but the darkened glow of the embers, and I could hardly make out amongst the shadows of furniture Donorita sunk on her knees in a penitential and despairing attitude. Before this collapse I, who had been wrestling desperately with her a moment before, felt that I dare not touch her. This emotion too, I could not understand. This abandonment of herself, this conscience-stricken humility. A humbly imploring request to open the door came from the other side. Ortega kept on repeating, "Pen the door, open the door," in such an amazing variety of intonations, imperative, whining, persuasive, insinuating, and even unexpectedly jocose, that I really stood there smiling to myself, yet with a gloomy and uneasy heart. Then he remarked, parenthetically as it were, "Oh, you know how to torment a man, you brown-skinned, lean, grinning, disheveled imp, you." "And Mark," he expounded further, in a curiously doctoral tone, "who are in all your limbs hateful. Your eyes are hateful, and your mouth is hateful, and your hair is hateful, and your body is cold, and vicious like a snake, and altogether you are perdition." This statement was astonishingly deliberate. He drew a moaning breath after it, and uttered in a heart-rending tone, "You know, Rita, that I cannot live without you. I haven't lived. I am not living now. This isn't life. Come, Rita, you can't take a boy's soul away, and then let him grow up, and go about the world, poor devil, while you go amongst the rich from one pair of arms to another, showing all your best tricks. But I will forgive you, if you only open the door," he ended in an inflated tone. "You remember how you swore time after time to be my wife. You are more fit to be Satan's wife, but I don't mind. You shall be my wife." A sound near the floor made me bend down hastily with a stern, "Don't laugh," for in his grotesque, almost burlesque discourses there seemed to me to be truth, passion, and horror enough to move a mountain. Suddenly suspicion seized him out there. With perfectly farcical unexpectedness he yelled shrilly, "H, you deceitful wretch! You won't escape me! I will have you!" Dot, and in a manner of speaking he vanished. Of course I couldn't see him, but somehow that was the impression. I had hardly time to receive it when crash! Dot dot dot, he was already at the other door. I suppose he thought that his prey was escaping him. His swiftness was amazing, almost inconceivable, more like the effect of a trick, or of a mechanism. The thump on the door was awful, as if he had not been able to stop himself in time. The shock seemed enough to stun an elephant. It was really funny. And after the crash there was a moment of silence, as if he were recovering himself. The next thing was a low grunt, and at once he picked up the thread of his fixed idea. "You will have to be my wife. I have no shame. You swore you would be, and so you will have to be." Stifled low sounds made me bend down again to the kneeling form, white in the flush of the dark red glow. "For goodness' sake don't," I whispered down. She was struggling with an appalling fit of merriment, repeating to herself, "Yes, every day, for 2 months. 60 times at least. Her voice was rising high. She was struggling against laughter, but when I tried to put my hand over her lips I felt her face wet with tears. She turned it this way and that, eluding my hand with repressed low, little moans. I lost my caution and said, "Be quiet," so sharply as to startle myself and her, too, into expectant stillness. Ortega's voice in the hall asked distinctly, "H? What's this?" And then he kept still on his side listening, but he must have thought that his ears had deceived him. He was getting tired too. He he was keeping quiet out there resting. Presently he sighed deeply, then in a harsh melancholy tone he started again. My love, my soul, my life, do speak to me. What am I, that you should take so much trouble to pretend that you aren't there? Do speak to me, he repeated tremulously, following this mechanical appeal with a string of extravagantly endearing names, some of them quite childish, which all of a sudden stopped dead. And then after a pause there came a distinct, unutterably weary, "What shall I do now?" as though he were speaking to himself. I shuddered to hear rising from the floor, by my side, a vibrating, scornful, "Oh, why, slink off home looking over your shoulder as you used 2 years ago, when I had done with you all but the laughter." "Rita," I murmured, appalled. He must have been struck dumb for a moment. Then, goodness only knows why, in his dismay or rage he was moved to speak in French with a most ridiculous accent. "So you have found your tongue at last, Captain. You were that from the cradle. Don't you remember how?" Donna Rita sprang to her feet at my side with a loud cry, "No, George, no," which bewildered me completely. The suddenness, the loudness of it made the ensuing silence on both sides of the door perfectly awful. It seemed to me that, if I didn't resist with all my might, something in me would die on the instant. In the straight, falling folds of the nightdress she looked cold like a block of marble, while I, too, was turned into stone by the terrific clamor in the hall. "Therese, Therese," yelled Ortega. "He has got a man in there." He ran to the foot of the stairs and screamed again, "Therese, Therese, there is a man with her. A man. Come down, you miserable, starved peasant, come down and see." I don't know where Therese was, but I am sure that this voice reached her, terrible, as if clamoring to heaven, and with a shrill over note which made me certain that if she was in bed the only thing she would think of doing would be to put her head under the bedclothes. With a final yell, "Come down and see," he flew back at the door of the room and started shaking it violently. It was a double door, very tall, and there must have been a lot of things loose about its fittings, bolts, latches, and all those brass applications with broken screws, because it rattled, it clattered, it jingled, and produced also the sound, as of thunder rolling in the big, empty hall. It was deafening, distressing, and vaguely alarming, as if it could bring the house down. At the same time the futility of it had, it cannot be denied, a comic effect. The very magnitude of the racket he raised was funny. But he couldn't keep up that violent exertion continuously, and when he stopped to rest we could hear him shouting to himself in vengeful tones. He saw it all. He had been decoyed there. Rattle, rattle, rattle. He had been decoyed into that town, he screamed, getting more and more excited by the noise he made himself, in order to be exposed to this. Rattle, rattle. By this shameless Captain. 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 He started at the door again with superhuman vigor. Behind me I heard Donna Rita laughing softly, statuesque, turned all dark in the fading glow. I called out to her quite openly, "Do keep your self-control." And she called back to me in a clear voice, "H, my dear, will you ever consent to speak to me after all this? But don't ask for the impossible. He was born to be laughed at." "Yes," I cried. "Don't let yourself go." I don't know whether Ortega heard us. He was exerting then his utmost strength of lung against the infamous plot to expose him to the derision of the fiendish associates of that obscene woman. Then he began another interlude upon the door, so sustained and strong, that I had the thought that this was growing absurdly impossible, that either the plaster would begin to fall off the ceiling or he would drop dead next moment, out there. He stopped, uttered a few curses at the door, and seemed calmer from sheer exhaustion. "This story will be all over the world," we heard him begin. "Deceived, decoyed, invade, in order to be made a laughing stock before the most debased of all mankind, that woman and her associates." This was really a meditation. And then he screamed, "I will kill you all. Once more he started worrying the door, but it was a startlingly feeble effort which he abandoned almost at once. He must have been at the end of his strength. Dona Rita from the middle of the room asked me recklessly loud, "Elmi, wasn't he born to be laughed at?" I didn't answer her. I was so near the door that I thought I ought to hear him panting there. He was terrifying, but he was not serious. He was at the end of his strength, of his breath, of every kind of endurance, but I did not know it. He was done up, finished, but perhaps he did not know it himself. How still he was. Just as I began to wonder at it, I heard him distinctly give a slap to his forehead. "See it all," he cried. "That miserable, canting peasant woman upstairs has arranged it all. No doubt she consulted her priests. I must regain my self-respect. Let her die first." I heard him make a dash for the foot of the stairs. I was appalled, yet to think of Therese being hoisted with her own petard was like a turn of affairs in a farce. A very ferocious farce. Instinctively I unlocked the door. Dona Rita's contralto laugh rang out loud, bitter, and contemptuous, and I heard Ortega's distracted screaming, as if under torture. "Tea hurts. It hurts. It hurts." I hesitated just an instant, half a second, no more, but before I could open the door wide there was in the hall a short groan, and the sound of a heavy fall. The sight of Ortega lying on his back at the foot of the stairs arrested me in the doorway. One of his legs was drawn up, the other extended fully, his foot very near the pedestal of the silver statuette holding the feeble and tenacious gleam which made the shadows so heavy in that hall. One of his arms lay across his breast. The other arm was extended full length on the white and black pavement with the hand palm upwards, and the fingers rigidly spread out. The shadow of the lowest step slanted across his face, but one whisker and part of his chin could be made out. He appeared strangely flattened. He didn't move at all. He was in his shirt sleeves. I felt an extreme distaste for that sight. The characteristic sound of a key whirring in the lock stole into my ears. I couldn't locate it, but I didn't attend much to that at first. I was engaged in watching Senor Ortega. But for his raised leg he clung so flat to the floor, and had taken on himself such a distorted shape, that he might have been the mere shadow of Senor Ortega. It was rather fascinating, to see him so quiet at the end of all that fury, clamor, passion, and uproar. Surely there was never anything so still in the world as this Ortega. I had a bizarre notion that he was not to be disturbed. A noise like the rattling of chain links, a small grind and click exploded in the stillness of the hall, and Aesiev began to swear in Italian. These surprising sounds were quite welcome, they recalled me to myself, and I perceived they came from the front door which seemed pushed a little ajar. Was somebody trying to get in? I had no objection, I went to the door and said, "Wait a moment, it's on the chain." The deep voice on the other side said, "Had an extraordinary thing," and I assented mentally. It was extraordinary. The chain was never put up, but Therese was a thorough sort of person, and on this night she had put it up to keep no one out except myself. It was the old Italian and his daughters returning from the ball who were trying to get in. Suddenly I became intensely alive to the whole situation. I bounded back, closed the door of Blunt's room, and the next moment was speaking to the Italian. "Little patience." My hands trembled, but I managed to take down the chain, and as I allowed the door to swing open a little more I put myself in his way. He was burly, venerable, a little indignant, and full of thanks. Behind him his two girls, in short-skirted costumes, white stockings, and low shoes, their heads powdered and earrings sparkling in their ears, huddled together behind their father, wrapped up in their light mantles. One had kept her little black mask on her face, the other held hers in her hand. The Italian was surprised at my blocking the way and remarked pleasantly, "It's cold outside, Signor." I said, "Yes," and added in a hurried whisper, "Here is a dead man in the hall." He didn't say a single word, but put me aside a little, projected his body in for one searching glance. Our daughters, I murmured. He said kindly, Virginia Bean, Va Bean. And then to them, come in, girls. There is nothing like dealing with a man who has had a long past of out-of-the-way experiences. The skill with which he rounded up and drove the girls across the hall, paternal and irresistible, venerable and reassuring, was a sight to see. They had no time for more than one scared look over the shoulder. He hustled them in and locked them up safely in their part of the house, then crossed the hall with a quick practical stride. When near Senor Ortega he trod short just in time and said, "En truth, blood." Then selecting the place, knelt down by the body in his tall hat and respectable overcoat, his white beard giving him immense authority somehow. "But this man is not dead," he exclaimed, looking up at me. With profound sagacity, inherent as it were in his great beard, he never took the trouble to put any questions to me, and seemed certain that I had nothing to do with the ghastly sight. He managed to give himself an enormous gash in his side, was his calm remark. "And he what a weapon," he exclaimed, getting it out from under the body. It was an Abyssinian or Nubian production of a bizarre shape, the clumsiest thing imaginable, partaking of a sickle and a chopper with a sharp edge and a pointed end. A mere cruel-looking curio of inconceivable clumsiness to European eyes. The old man let it drop with amused disdain. Who had better take hold of his legs, he decided without appeal. I certainly had no inclination to argue. When we lifted him up, the head of Senor Ortega fell back desolately, making an awful, defenseless display of his large, white throat. We found the lamp burning in the studio, and the bed made upon the couch on which we deposited our burden. My venerable friend jerked the upper sheet away at once, and started tearing it in two strips. "You may leave him to me," said that efficient sage, "but the doctor is your affair. If you don't want this business to make a noise, you will have to find a discreet man." He was most benevolently interested in all the proceedings. He remarked with a patriarchal smile as he tore the sheet noisily, "You had better not lose any time." I didn't lose any time. I crammed into the next hour an astonishing amount of bodily activity. Without more words, I flew out bareheaded into the last night of carnival. Luckily, I was certain of the right sort of doctor. He was an iron-gray man of 40, and of a stout habit of body, but who was able to put on a spurt. In the cold, dark, and deserted by streets, he ran with earnest and ponderous footsteps, which echoed loudly in the cold night air, while I skimmed along the ground a pace or two in front of him. It was only on arriving at the house that I perceived that I had left the front door wide open. All the town, every evil in the world could have entered the black and white hall. But I had no time to meditate upon my imprudence. The doctor and I worked in silence for nearly an hour, and it was only then, while he was washing his hands in the fencing room, that he asked. What was he up to, that imbecile? Oh, he was examining this curiosity, I said. Oh, yes, and it accidentally went off, said the doctor, looking contemptuously at the Nubian knife I had thrown on the table. Then while wiping his hands, would bet there is a woman somewhere under this. But that of course does not affect the nature of the wound. I hope this bloodletting will do him good. Nothing will do him any good, I said. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.